are going to hang in there. It is.
That's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Welcome back to another episode of The Smiley Show. And man, this is golf's off season that wasn't an off season. We have so much to get to this week. I'm Charlie Hume. He's of course Smiley Kaufman, and Smiley live from the Bahamas, just off the course. I believe today, you were walking around with Tiger Woods. You were walking around with the guy who eventually won the tournament, Scottie Scheffler, walking around with Justin Thomas. So you certainly got your steps in. We are going to get to the Hero World Challenge right off the top here. We're also going to get to more developments in the PGA Tour PIF framework deal, the news about the ball rollback. We'll talk about that later in the show. But let's kind of start with what, despite all the other stuff, unsurprisingly, dominated the conversation in the golf world this week, and that was Tiger's return to competitive golf, his first competitive round since the Masters. And yeah, like I said, you walked them for a few holes today, and I think, you know, largely felt like it was a success. I mean, if you look at the stats, he hit it really good off the tee Friday through Sunday. Seemed like he struggled all week long with approach shots, at least what the stats will tell you. Was good around the green on Friday and Saturday. Had a kind of a rough Sunday performance, chipping, which tanked the stats in that department. But just let's begin with your overall takeaways on the week that Tiger Woods had and the level of optimism it gives you for his play on the PGA Tour and in majors going forward.
Yeah, first off, I mean, it was great having him back. I mean, it was great that he finished, you know, 72 holes. I think first and foremost, that was my goal for Tiger this week, was for him to finish. You asked for expectations for what would be a good week for him. And I said, as long as he doesn't finish last, I think that's a positive step in the right direction. Didn't finish last, finished 18th. So, you know, wasn't necessarily the best performance that probably he was looking for. And you're right. Yeah, I got to watch him play a lot of golf. I walked with him on Friday, covered him in the early coverage when I was in the booth on Saturday, and walked with him on the grounds on Sunday again, which first off is that's the first time I've ever walked with Tiger. I covered him at the Masters in the booth in the digital coverage. So I have covered him before, but that was the first time I've been on the ground and really watched him play. You know, I think I may have saw him as a kid play at a tournament or two, but really being up close and seeing the ball flight, seeing the different trajectories that he hit shots with. And honestly, dude, he looks like a linebacker right now.
It's wild. He is built.
I walked up to his trainer and I was just like, dude, like, do you think I could tackle Tiger? And I even asked Sam Burns that today. I was like, do you think I could? And he's like, yeah, no. So, I mean, dude, he's absolutely jacked. You would not believe his upper half right now. It's absolutely insane. But his golf was, I would say, positive. You know, he, like you said, with the putting, you know, that was one of his stats that were not great, but through two rounds, he was leading the field in the most amount of feet made in putts. So he was actually putting really well outside of like 10 feet. He was holding the longer stuff. He just was really inconsistent inside of 6 feet, which to me, he's been inconsistent inside of 6 feet for a long time. Like, mm-hmm. I can't remember the last time he was like bulletproof from that distance when I watch him play on TV. And granted, he's been injured. He hasn't played much golf. Maybe that's an area that it can be rusty, but you would think that's what he would be doing the most, is like putting from that range. But, and the irons definitely, it didn't look like he was mishitting too many shots. It's that he couldn't get the ball to curve quite the way he wanted it to. Like, he was trying to hit the shots, and he like couldn't get the spin on the golf ball. Like, for instance, if he's, you know, there's a left flag stick, Tiger Woods is the best at using the middle of the green to get to an area of the green. So he sees a left pin, he's going to aim at the middle of the green, he's going to hit a draw. And it's a shot that any pro would love to hit. And not too many do in this day and age. A lot of guys just hit very straight shots. or hold winds to make the ball go straight. So if the wind is right to left, they're going to hit a fade against it to make it go as straight as possible. Where Tiger really likes using the middle of the green, and working it to flag sticks. But yeah, man, it was really fun being out there. Like, his game, I really think is really high quality. I mean, I really think he can win in 2024. Would not surprise me at all. I think winning a major championship would be a bit of a stretch. Mm-hmm. I think he really needs the golf courses to be firm, because it is a little bit of a lower flight at times. But towards the end of the week, I started to see him hitting some drives up in the air more so than he was at the beginning of the week, which kind of defeats that argument. I'm thinking, okay, never mind. Like, I was thinking he needed to be on firm golf courses to compete. That wasn't the case by the end of the week. I was like, this guy's moving it. So the distance to win at the professional level, that has not gone away. I think he was very rusty in his iron game, and we know that he's been the best iron player that you can argue in the history of the game of golf. So you know the skill in the game is still there for him to be able to hone in on that. And he talked about the rust, and he talked about that he's still got game to win. So I believe him. I saw it firsthand. You know, I think it was interesting how he talked about at the end of the round today, just about the week and just kind of how you just referred to playing more golf, maybe once a month in the next 12 months.
Yes.
And how that would look. He said, you know, play a week, maybe take 2 weeks off, prepare for a week, or 2 weeks off being recover for 2 weeks, or and then practice for a week and then go to the tournament. And in my head, I'm thinking, you know what, that could really work.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to see.
Well, let's game that out. I think that's a perfect segue, because as soon as he said that, and he was speaking to Todd Lewis in his interview after the round today, my wheels started to spin of like, okay, let's look at a calendar and let's figure out where we could see him. And so I think the dates you can probably definitively pencil in, right, are, of course, the Masters in April, the PGA in May, the US Open in June, and the Open Championship in July. So if we're working off that calendar, I'd assume then that
in all of those, he'll just get a special exemption into, besides, like, he gets into the Masters being a past champion. The U.S. Open was always a 10-year thing, but he's not in by world ranking, so he would have to get a special exemption, which I'm sure he would. So all those, you'd have to assume that he would get the special invite to be able to compete.
That's an interesting one as to how that would work, because, you know, how do you – I think, you know, if it's an Open – right? If it's like the Open Championship or the U.S. Open, I guess the sanctity of the competition resides in that it is open, that anyone can qualify, but also that everyone has to live by the same criteria. So I wonder if they do it where they kind of rewrite the criteria every year, and maybe there's, you know, maybe there's like...
They're always can give exemptions. You see it every year, right, at the other three that I just mentioned. U.S. Open, it's like a 10-year deal. PGA, I don't remember, in the Open Championship.
Just write in. It's the 50 win exemption. If you have 50 wins on the PGA Tour,
the rule is if Tiger Woods wants to play, he gets in. That's the rule.
It's a good one, by the way. So, like, just kind of taking this back. So you assume that the February event would have to be the Genesis, of course, tournament he hosts. Do we think we see him at the Players in March? Does that feel like the most logical fit?
I don't think he can get into the Players.
Ah, okay.
That, so then, seems how about like one that I, unless the PGA Tour has this random special temporary deal, but I think it's all based off a number for that event. So I don't think he should get into whatever he wants to play in. But I think that one is very specific on world ranking and a points list.
So what about, so there, then the next logical one in March seems like the API, given his past success at Bay Hill and the fact there are those four exemptions where you could use one there.
I think Bay Hill would be a good guess.
Now, do we think we see him in January at all? Because obviously not in Century, and your other options there are Sony Open, Amex, Farmers Insurance Open. I guess you could kind of fudge the numbers and say the AT&T Pro-Am, while it's the first week in February, maybe that's one because of past success at Pebble and the fact small that, again, field. You have those four exemptions. We could see him there.
What's the date of that versus when is Genesis, which is the LA?
That's a good call, Riviera. Too. So AT&T Pro-Am is February 1st through 4th. And then Genesis is February 15th through 18th. Like I could see it where he just doesn't. The first event he plays on tour is the Genesis in this next year because it's a tough scene in January. Like I'm not sure how you make that work. So then that kind of gets us sorted through July, and then at that point it's like I wonder if he just kind of calls it for the season, because then you start getting into FedEx Cup playoffs in August. I mean, it's the Olympics first event in August, and then Wyndham Championship, and then you're in the FedEx Cup playoffs. So that might very well be a rough outline on Tiger's schedule for 2024. And then that'd be a pretty good one. So Genesis, API,
the majors. Dude, he's not playing. Like he'll never win another FedEx Cup. Like he's not going to be able to have the grind of playing enough. So your expectations of where he is in the FedEx Cup, it's all for him now is like, can he pick off another win somewhere? And I think that's all anybody really cares about and that's all he cares about too, is winning. I can't imagine that he is concerned at all about his FedEx Cup position and playing enough to make the tour championship. I don't think East Lake is even something that he's probably even considering, because he'll probably say, you know what, I'm not going to get enough at bats.
Yeah. Which makes complete sense. The moment he said playing once every month, I was like, let's go take a look at the calendar. So we'll come back to Tiger later in the show, because we have to talk about Tiger's new role off the course on the PGA Tour policy board and unpack some stuff that he said earlier in the week. And even, you know, after some rounds on Friday, reacting to news that was pretty important. But just to move to the Scottie Scheffler, who won this tournament. This is going to end up being a very putting themed review of the Hero World Challenge. But Scotty, I think the thing we saw all season was best ball striker on the planet, just complete breakdown on the green. And I think this was a really encouraging showing this week. He was sixth in strokes gained putting in the field. And again, I know some of these stats are a little skewed, it's a 20 player field, but still upper half of the field. And that was with, he lost more than 3 strokes on the greens today and still got the job done. So to me, like that feels like a success. He's of course got the new putter. I forget the name of the company, but sort of like a boutique putter company that made a new head for him. It's an inch and a half shorter. It's a fatter grip to kind of take his hands out of it. We know, of course, he's been working with Phil Kenyon, and I heard on the broadcast today that he's reading his own putts now, worrying less about alignment and kind of more just about, you know, what feels right to him. So with all that information, everything you covered this week, following him around, like how did the putting look just from an eye test perspective this week for Scottie Scheffler?
Well, yeah, the stats don't lie. You know, finishing sixth is a big jump. And you just mentioned that Ted Scott is not involved in the green reading. And that was something I really noticed last year with Scotty. You know, too often he would miss a putt and he would look straight at Ted Scott. And it's like, God, like, how did it break that way? It was just, he never, it seemed like, made the decision for himself on what the putt was going to do. Never had the conviction enough to be like, Ted, just stay over there. I'm a good green reader. I know what I'm doing. And Ted was a part of all the reads, and they made it a little bit too complicated between it. And Phil Kenyon, from what I understand, has brought to the table, besides helping him with structure in his putting stroke from the technique side and getting him into a putter that's more suited to what he is in now, which is a 34 and a half inch putter versus 36, which I like. You know, he gave Scottie Scheffler the advice of, dude, you are a good green reader, and I'm going to prove it to you. We're going to go out there and we're going to use a leveler, and you're going to use, and we're going to practice aim point, and you're going to realize that you are a really good green reader. And it's not like other guys who, you know, maybe struggle at the skill of green reading. And from what I understand, the two of them figured out is that's not Scotty's issue. It's just having conviction in it. And I think too often, when guys are struggling with putter, is first off, is, are you getting it started on wine? If you're not getting it started on wine, we need to look at technique. I do think the putter change helped him with his technique to be able to hit it more out of the center more often than not. Too often last year, I saw him standing way too straight up. It's like his eyes were way too far away from the golf ball. And then he was hitting a lot of his putts in the heel. And when you hit a lot of putts in the heel of the putter, you have a lot of pulls. And I'm not saying we got to like yip territory, but we definitely got into a mental rut. And we saw that with the stats. I mean, it was absurd, his finishes that he had with the stats that he performed on the putting green. So with that being said, with this week and what he did, I mean, he's an elite ball striker. I don't think I've ever seen somebody with my own eyes hit it as good as Scotty does. I say that pretty confidently. I think Rory can get that way at times as far as trajectory of shots and just control. But Scotty does it every day. You know, it's one after the other. And it was actually funny today. On the back of the range, I was driving by, riding around the golf course, doing some work, trying to look at some hole locations. And I see somebody hitting on the back of the range, and I drive over there, and it's Ted Scott. And he's practicing hitting golf balls, and he's practicing his driver. And I go over there and talk to him. And by the way, he's got a great golf swing, Ted Scott. He's got some speed.
He's a player.
He's got some speed too, and he was working on his driver, and I was watching him. But, you know, I was asking him, I was like, man, how easy is it caddying for Scotty Scheffler? He said, you wouldn't believe it, man. I mean, he points out, you know, what about aiming at those people right there behind the green? He's like, yeah, right there's perfect. Lands on them. You know, it's that over and over again. It's like on the TV tower here, is this the line with the driver? On him. Like, it's just over and over again, the guy hits it exactly where he's looking. And not only that, dude, he hits it pin high just about every single time. And you want to go play with a good player, one of the first things you should see out of a really good player, and if you don't see this out of people you're playing with at home and you think they're a good player, you need to check yourself, because hitting it pin high is the most important thing for a really high skilled golfer. If you're not hitting it pin high, it's going to be really difficult to make a living playing golf. But that's something that Scotty Scheffler is practicing so much, and all of these guys are. Every single day, they have their track man out. Like, whether the conditions are 40 in Dallas or it's 85 degrees here in Nassau, every single shot, their 7-iron numbers are changing, their driver numbers are changing, and they're adjusting on the fly. And nobody is as good as making those adjustments in Scotty Scheffler.
Yeah. By the way, Ted Scott, 8 a.m. tee time tomorrow, heard from some inside sources. So not surprised he was tuning it up on the back of the range. As far as Scotty goes, it's funny. I was putting together the rundown for today's show, and I wrote the putting notes in. And I was like, I don't know if there's anything else to talk about, because much like all of last season, it's, yep, still the best ball striker on the planet. So I think that's about all we need to say about him is that that remains the same. And if he starts putting it well, then it could be another really, really good season for him. To continue the I guess, putting theme of sorts, but really just an overall look at another guy who is returning from injury, Will Zalatoris. And, you know, I just want to preface all this by saying, I think you and I talk a lot off air and are rooting really, really hard for Will Zalatoris and his comeback and hoping he can put it all together. But just taking a look at his week, and, you know, it was a tough one for him. I know he entered the week, you know, said one of the press conferences, this is an R&D week. Like, we're just trying to kind of gather some information and figure out where we're at, knock the rust off. And so he may look at this and feel, you know, less bad at this than maybe it looks like on paper. But Thursday's putting was, you know, he would probably tell you himself, it was really, really bad. He lost nearly 6 shots on the green, which was 3.6 shots worst in the strokes game putting category than the 19th place finisher, Wyndham Clark. But then he turns right around on Friday, finishes 3rd in that category. And then even though he lost strokes in that category on Saturday and Sunday, it was less than a shot both days. So looking at that shift of the broomstick, you know, it's like there was some potential there, even though Thursday was a little bit of a mess. So then off of that, if we're looking at putting as the main culprit for the 81 he shot on Thursday. It looked like it was kind of the irons and the wedges that did him in on Saturday when he shot that 79, because he was negative 3.6 strokes gain approach and negative 4.8 strokes gain around the green on Saturday. And I just thought, like, the last kind of piece that I was trying to keep an eye on to seeing where he was at was distance relative to accuracy. So another thing he said at the beginning of the week was these swing changes that he's making to accommodate the back surgery and his sort of new normal, that those changes were going to result in less speed and less distance, but that he felt like he was going to be a more accurate driver of the golf ball. And he finished 17th in the field in driving distance and 18th in driving accuracy. So maybe not as good as he would have liked. So look, all that said, first tournament back, a lot of rust to knock off. Just from what you saw this week and just, you know, in the stats and just on the course, if you're Will's team, what are you taking away and where are you going from here?
Yeah, no, I got to watch him play a little bit on Thursday. And so I saw him get off to, you know, not the best of starts. Like, that was not exactly what he had in the cooker thinking for his Thursday start. But here's the thing. Will Zalatoris is one of the most talented players on the PGA Tour. It's not even close. I've seen it too many times how incredible of a ball striker this guy is. It's top five. That's how good it is. So he's been off for 7 months and he's made a ton of changes. And when it comes to making changes in the game of golf, sometimes you're going to have some serious inconsistencies. And we saw it this week. I mean, he's a great ball striker, like I just mentioned, but they've made some changes just a little bit. You know, they're trying to get a little bit stronger face. They're actually working a little bit with the Pro Sender device that, you know, we've had, you know, David Woods and Sean Foley on. He's been working with that, trying to get a little bit of a stronger face, but he's changed his setup a little bit to where he's not trying to have quite as much pressure on his back. And with that comes new feels and probably things that used to be easy for him to make adjustments on. Maybe it just is a little off. So let's chalk up the full swing to maybe an adjustment or two that he didn't know how to make and just a loose shot that maybe he might not be quite used to yet. But when it comes to the short game category, you can throw out any around the green statistic this week for any single one of these players because they had a rain out here that was like 7 inches. This would have been 10 to 14 days ago, I'm told, that it rained 7 inches in like an hour. So the water sat out there, and they also had issues with Bermuda mites, which I've never even heard what this is.
Yeah, I was like, what is that?
And the TV didn't really show how bad these fairways were. They were probably the worst fairways I've ever seen on the PGA Tour. And that's, you can ask any player that they were that it was that bad. I never saw one good lie the entire week. Every single one of them was not good. Nothing was ever sitting up. Chipping was an absolute nightmare. I'm telling you, nightmare. I saw more players putting off the green, chipping with five irons, chipping with pitching wedges, anything with bounce, because you try to chip with a 60 degree and you could double hit it just like that if you were a little bit behind it. And so, like, being shallow was not an option with a 60 degree because the potential to get that leading edge in the ground, you could hit it a foot in front of you. And so let's throw that out the window, because And let me say this too. We saw guys chip the entire week and hit really good chip shots. And every single time I would think to myself, people have no idea how good this is because I'm saying, man, that was an incredible chip shot. And people are like, what are you talking about? Like, that's not that hard of a chip shot. You didn't see the lie and you don't know exactly how these wedges are going through the ground right now. It's an absolute nightmare for somebody that can't chip. So, and the grain has always been an issue out there from what I'm told. It's been like just as bad as Kapalua as far as dealing with the grain with chipping. So, throw that out the window for Will Zalatoris. I'll get back to him in the broomstick putter. And I talked probably to Josh Gregory, his short game coach, for a good 20, 30 minutes earlier in the week about his process of what he's doing with the broomstick, which I know you're a big fan of.
And I'm a broomstick guy. Like I could go, I mean, while you're talking, I could go just grab the new broom. I think I was actually looking at, cause there's like the Mez 1 and the Mez 1 Max. I believe he opted for the Max model. I think Will and I might have the exact same putter. So my ears perked up a little bit when I was like, oh, wait a second. Here we go. Let's see how this goes. So anyway, that's a bit of a diversion that nobody cares about.
Well, back to broomstick, yeah. Those lab putters. I was talking to Lucas Glover walking down the fairway.
And I heard you say this. Yes.
And he was telling me that it's like a 6-month back order for tour players to get these things. Like it's not easy to get one right now, but not an issue for if you're a producer of a Sirius XM radio show. Charlie Hume had no problem ordering himself a broomstick and getting there in a week or two.
I said, listen, do you know who I produce for? Smiley Kaufman. You better have this thing here in under 2 weeks or I'm going to throw a fit. No, it was those guys were good. We reached out after Lucas's wins, I think at the Wyndham early in the FedEx Cup, and they hooked it up. So it's been fun. I have not been able to give it a full run because I've had a large plastic brace on my neck that made the whole broomstick motion a little wonky, but I'm looking forward to kind of getting down to Florida at the end of the month and digging into it. But anyway, that's a diversion from the man who actually matters using the broomstick, Will's Outdoors. So you said you talked to Josh Gregory, his short game coach, about this. And what did Josh have to say?
Well, one of the things that they've been working on, which is actually similar to the process that he used to have in with the arm lock. So he likes to get all of his weight 80-20 on his front foot, on his left foot. So he gets in there with the similar setup to what he had. And I have a couple of videos too that he sent me, mm-hmm. And it looks really good. And you talked about how on Friday he was third in putting. And to me, the first thing that changes when guys have gone to the broomstick is their rhythm immediately gets better. And I don't know why, if it's the weight that, or you have to just use your shoulders, but there's none of that huge hiccup in the stroke. And when we used to see Will Zalatoris really struggle inside of 4 feet, it was the reroute, it was the bit of a hit, it was just, you know, kind of gross. And he had a little bit of that from one camera angle that I saw.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of a hitch. It's better. And we expected to see a little bit of it. I don't think that's something that's just going to naturally go away. There's plenty of players that have gone through stuff like this in different parts of their game. And he knows it. This is a battle that he's going to continue to have to deal with his putting. Is it going to make or break him ever winning a major? I mean, that remains to be seen, but he was dang near close to winning a couple already. And I think his putting stroke looks better now. So he's always been better outside of that 7-8 foot range. You could see it in his stroke. He's got much more conviction in that. So as he progresses in it, I think he'll continue to get better. You know, we've seen Lucas Glover, what it's done for his game. You know, the shakes that you get in your hand, as any golfer knows, those will start to go away with the more confidence you get. And I think we'll start to see that from Will. He just needs more at bats. It's going to be a long road for him with his back. He came back, you know, after 7 months, but it's going to be a similar type of process that maybe we saw with, remember Patrick Cantlay when he came back and how long it would take him to warm up before days, similar to like what we're seeing with Tiger Woods. Mm-hmm. His warmups for his back are probably going to be 3 hours before the round. And that's this type of things that Will Zalatoris it's going to be his new normal for a little while as he monitors this back and makes sure that he doesn't re-injure it. So it's good to see that both Tiger and Will finish this week, no injuries. Tiger at the end of the week definitely looked a little sore, and I didn't get to see Will at the end of the week, but I imagine them both finishing and being able to assess, you know, where their games are at after such a long layoff.
Yeah, it's specific to the putting on Will, and again, this is your 5 handicap speaking alert here, but the thing that has been the weirdest for me with the broomstick and trying to figure out is it's almost like you're learning a completely different motion. So when I look at his stats and you see the how well he putted on Friday, like that to me says that's the potential upside. That's where he can be once he kind of gets comfortable with the motion. But, you know, the video of like that flutter you saw, I mean, it really is weird trying to say my entire life I've done this thing and so much of this is in my hands. And now I have to like almost figure out which muscle groups to use. And you know, are they different? And, you know, what, you know, which muscle groups am I recruiting? You know, which ones, you know, how am I supposed to kind of take this away and you know, follow through? And so I could easily see how, and I think also you kind of need a guide in that journey as well, where someone who has figured out the transition, you know, years before, we can say, hey, this is kind of what I did to kind of help me out, and then get viewpoints from whether it's Lucas Glover or someone else, you know, so I think there's a little bit of, you know, flying blind, you know, initially we were trying to kind of figure out the thing that makes the most sense. But, you know, to me that the way he put it on Friday is like, okay, this is clearly a guy who is getting to a place where he's going to be more comfortable putting. It's just that you can easily have a Thursday where you're like, wait a second, I'm my first competitive round in months, and I'm just trying to kind of figure out how this is supposed to go. And it's just, I just don't have it today. So, but yeah, I mean, my hope is that, you know, I think your hope as well is that, figure it out and get to a better place and heal up, get more comfortable. And we're going to see the talented player that we know is in there. So just a few other sort of, you know, quick hitters from the Hero before we kind of move on to some of these big picture news topics. The Colin Morikawa penalty, man, this was like a interesting subplot unfolding.
100% subplot, right?
Well, it was so funny because I didn't hear about it last night, and I had the broadcast on today, and they kept mentioning it. There was going to be a rules official joining the broadcast. And there was the first kind of piece of the story where, you know, this conversation that, you know, that was a little bit heated, you know, with JJ Jakubowiak and Colin and Steve, and I forget the guy's last name.
Yeah. Stephen Cox.
And then there were just more and more details that kept filtering out throughout the course of the broadcast where, oh, by the way, it was Matt Fitzpatrick and Billy Foster that overheard something on the green and maybe reported these guys. And then you talked to Colin after the round, and Colin was like, look, I get it, but that's not the way it's been enforced. I've talked to other rules officials, other caddies. This is what they've said. No, by the way, this guy interrupted me in the middle of my warm-up and had me waiting in the locker room for 5-10 minutes. And I didn't particularly care for that either, as I'm trying to go play, you know, a Sunday round at a PGA Tour event. So all very intriguing. I'm curious what, you know, if there's any additional clarity or thoughts that you can kind of provide from being on the ground and talking to people there about what the deal was with that whole situation.
Yeah, we didn't find out about it last night, and nobody heard about it. We only found out about this penalty when we were on the air. This is probably 45 minutes to when we started the show. So everything that seemed to be kind of confusing to the viewer at the beginning of like, wait, what is going on? Like, so he got a penalty. Now we got an official coming in to explain it all. And then like, we just kept on finding out more and more information as the show went on. And that's sometimes how it goes. And we delivered it as we could. And when that information came in, but to speak to maybe Colin and the Stephen Cox, when those two talked about, you know, the ruling and, you know, him not being in the locker room on time for when they said they wanted to meet. I get that as a player, you know, when you say, hey, let's meet in the locker room at what, I don't know if it was a text that said meet there at 11 and showed up at 11:05 and he's teeing off at 11:30. You know, that's interrupting a warm up on a day on a Sunday is a big deal. And, you know, some player, especially when you're delivered news like that, that you would never expect to be delivered. And from what I'm told, you know, this got told to the rules officials after the round, and they deliberated over it. Then they talked to obviously Colin and JJ about what was in the yardage book. They said, yes, this is what's in the yardage book. And to explain to the people that don't know what's going on with it, he was assessed a 2-stroke penalty for having information in his caddy's yardage book. And that information was some form of formula that they have figured out from the practice putting green with a level device. So this is something that they do either every day on the practice putting green or Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You're not able to now in the yardage book draw any slope arrows in particular areas. You can't take a green reading level or device on the actual greens of the golf course and put any levelers out there to help you with the slope of the green. It's supposed to be a natural thing that your eye is supposed to read, or that you can feel with your feet, like we say with the aim point. And now so often these players are using aim point, and there's certain formulas. If you recall from our Lee Hodges conversation, how he's doing a formula, it's like a math formula for coming up with how many inches out he's going to be aiming of the middle of the hole based on how far away he is away from the cup. And this all goes back to what was written in the yardage book. Mm-hmm. It was something to do with whether it's 10 feet away, on a 1 degree slope, it's 3 inches. I don't know what was written, something like that of that sort. And
can I ask you this quickly? Sorry to interrupt, but because I'm really curious, are you allowed to use the level on the practice putting green?
Yes.
But you just can't write down the formula in the book. So you'd have to use it and then memorize it.
You have to memorize it.
Got it. I just want to clarify that point, because that was confusing to me.
Gotta memorize it. Yeah. And that's basically it. And from what I'm told, Matthew noticed when Colin asked JJ for a read on the fourth hole on round that they were playing Saturday together, he noticed that JJ referenced something in the book. And that's something now that players are paying attention to, knowing, like, what are you looking at in the book? You know, like, there's nothing that you can really look at in your book right now as a player or caddy, because you really can't have any information in there besides that's naturally done in a practice round. So you can't really draw the arrows, and it's all very vague. And I think there's definitely a point made by Colin that the players, the caddies, and also the rules official, it's all a little vague to where we have a situation like this unfold.
Let's say you take your level out on the practice screen, you determine whatever your formula is, you do not write it down, but you have that in your head. In the same way that we see, you know, caddies and players standing over a shot and kind of calculating yardage using a pencil, are you allowed to do the math in your book? Like, are you allowed to with a memorized formula, do the math on a putt and say, this is how much it's supposed to break?
Maybe.
I guess this highlights how vague it is, but it's just all very confusing to me, and I understand why Colin and JJ were upset.
Yeah, and John Wood said this during a commercial break. Apparently, before the round happens or something like that, if a coach is out there watching the golf course, or a caddy's out there watching the golf course, and they tell you on the first hole, man, everybody is missing this fairway to the right, you can write that down in the book. And you can write down, don't miss this fairway to the right. Everybody's missing it to the right. But if that information, let's say on the green, the guy said, everybody is coming up short on the putt on the first hole, and you write that down in your book, the second part of it is something that is illegal and you can't write down. But the first thing is, it's everything associated with the green. That's information that is apparently deemed unusable.
You can't even write down that guys are coming up short on a putt.
I'm telling you, you're not supposed to have any information down when it pertains to a green. To me, that's the safest, most nebulous thing. It's the safest way right now to go about it, because the rules are so vague. I mean, to be honest,
wow,
how are you able to prove that they didn't look at anything else in the yardage book the entire week? We saw what happened on the fourth hole, but who's to say that? Like, to me, I was a little surprised that it was just a 2-shot penalty. It seemed like it was either a DQ or nothing in this scenario.
Well, did you hear, and Colin said this in his interview today, he said it kind of jokingly, but I wonder if he was kind of trying to cover his tracks a little bit. He's like, well, luckily I fired JJ from green reading on the first hole on Thursday, and this is the first time he looked at his book all week long. So again, the way he said it was kind of joking.
I'm not here to speculate on that, because it's hard for us to make that call, but
totally. It's just interesting information.
It seemed like a DQ or nothing in that situation, right? Like, if the formula is in there and you weren't supposed to use it.
All very strange. But certainly, I mean, I'd say it fit the larger storyline of this PGA Tour season, where just if there is drama to be had, we will have it. So interesting. And that's helpful insight to kind of parse that a little further. A few additional quick hitters. How about Birmingham, Alabama's finest Austrian, Sepp Straka?
I love Sepp because he actually listens to the show. Like, he's the guy that loves listening to the show.
How about it?
He loved the Victor Hovland episode.
Nice.
As a guy who struggled with the pitching, he really liked that episode. And I know that, dude, I mean, I'm just sitting here looking at Sepp. He's top 10 in everything this week from a stats standpoint.
It's amazing.
His golf swing doesn't get talked about enough. He swings the golf club so effortlessly. He plays the game in a simple way. You know, he plays a very straight to just a draw shot pretty much every time. The game doesn't overcomplicate him. And he's got a great attitude. And, man, top 20 in the world now. I mean, it's just been really impressive, the run that Sepp has been on. He's loves to play the game of golf. He's not a guy that's going to go grind practicing. He's just a guy that plays golf, and you know what he does? He makes a lot of birdies and not a lot of bogeys.
Yeah, look, Sepp, if you're listening, I know you're a man of many nicknames. I like to call you the microwave, because when you get hot, you get hot. I mean, that was just like a, here he goes. He's just kind of shooting up the leaderboard. So 64 for Sepp on Sunday to finish solo second. Another guy who got hot on Sunday is another friend of the show, Victor Hovland, with a 63 that could have been a lot lower, actually. I think he was
10 under
through 14 or 15, just was on fire. But yeah, after the first three rounds that were maybe uncharacteristic for Vic, given his recent form, good finish for him. And then JT, another friend of the show, a solo third. Good to kind of see him continue to trend in that direction. You noted this on the broadcast. Good finish at the Fortinet. Good finish at the Ned Bank Golf Challenge. This gets him to moves him a spot up in the OWGR to 26th. So that keeps him in that signature event fields for next season. So yeah, couple of items to get in the notes there. So what do you think, Smiley? Any other hero thoughts before we move on to the off season that's not off season in golf?
No, that's about it. I mean, shout out to Jordan Spieth's caddy, Eric Leyendecker. That's my boy. Right. Their bag broke like two or three different times. He was carrying it down the suitcase, like a suitcase on Saturday, and replacing Michael Greller for the week. But he did great. It was fun watching him out there too. So yeah, it was a great week. JT and Jordan both played well. Good to see them both have good weeks.
Yeah. Well, off we go to everything that happened off the course this week, which was a lot. And I think we got to, you know, start once again with this ongoing PGA Tour, PIF, LIV, you know, framework deal. And the big news of the week was the rumors that John Rahm, that there's some form of an agreement in place for him to go to LIV. And so here were the news items, or just however you want to say it, because I say this, I use news or reporting very lightly, because the accounts this was coming from, it's like, I don't know if these necessarily qualify as reporters, but what's being reported is he'll join for the 2024 season, that it is a contract that runs through 2029, that it's a $300 million total signing bonus paid over the life of his contract, that he will be given an option to either join Sergio's Fireballs team or captain his own team, which he'd own a quarter of, and that there is a $600 million total figure for his contract that includes team equity, which, you know, I guess the opinion of this is that it'll likely skyrocket with the signing. So I guess just let's start off the top. Just, you know, where's your head at with these rumors? And we've heard them before. This one felt maybe a little more concrete than past ones, but just your thoughts on where this whole thing stands with John Rahm.
Yeah, man. There's no doubt the rumor to John Rahm to live is definitely something that's being talked about. It's not just like this fake story. I don't know if those numbers are correct. I don't know about anything about that report as far as the contract and it, whether that's all correct in itself, but Rahm going to live is definitely something that it's being talked about. And 100%, I think you question a little bit, just, you know, as this framework agreement the deadline's, you know, December 31st. It just seems weird, right? You know, because the PGA Tour is trying to negotiate with the PIF. Why would they want to take away, you know, John Rahm in this? It just seems like a bargaining chip for LIV at the time, because if they get John Rahm, it just kind of you just lose just another star player to where it's like, you know, a while back, you know, the LIV Golf Tour didn't have, you know, the names and just the ammunition that it has now, you know, meeting with the PGA Tour and having this framework agreement. To me, dude, losing John Rahm is a big deal. Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, it would be really tough because, you know, when you look at who had the best years last year, you know, you say that Victor Hovland, John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, Scottie Scheffler, you know, and we've seen this next group that of players that are coming up. They're like the Ludvig Åberg. We have the Nicolai Højgaards. So there's a lot of young European talent coming up as well. And you wonder, it's like, man, where is it all going to stop? Because right now it just seems, unless they change the format or make it to where there's more players, first off, there doesn't seem to be enough spots for everybody to go. But they announced this LIV Golf Tour qualifier where you see some PGA Tour players that have signed up. So, dude, golf is an absolute mess right now. It is an absolute dumpster fire.
That's the only certainty.
And everybody that's coming in to listen to this, for us to have the answers if John Rahm is going or not, I can't specifically say whether he is or not. I would like to hear it from his team. I would like to hear it from somebody close from him. I don't have that right now. But I'll tell you this. I am concerned that he is going to go. I really do think that whatever happened back in June or July, whenever that date was, when it came out that the PGA Tour is merging with LIV on MSNBC or whatever channel it was on, that was a big deal to John Rahm. It was a big deal in the fact that he wasn't involved with the conversation. He wasn't alerted, being one of the top players on the PGA Tour. That meant something to him. And I think he's always felt like the PGA Tour hasn't been his tour, you know, that he hasn't been the guy talked about as being, you know, one of the leaders of the tour, one of the best players of the tour. We talk about him as the best players of the tour, but more so, you know, it's Tiger's tour, it's Rory's tour, it's, you know, Jordan and JT or whoever's tour. I think he feels slighted in the fact that, you know, if I go to the LIV Golf Tour, I mean, he may get to run that ship, and you can make an argument that he would. So listen, what doesn't make sense to me, and I know John, I've watched him play, I've watched him compete. The thing that doesn't make any sense to me at all is he's the most competitive golfer on the PGA Tour. Why is he going to go to the LIV Golf Tour where it is music blaring on every single hole? There's going to be people's cell phones going off all the time. He yells at somebody in the crowd every week that has their cell phone go off. I mean, and I say that because he is the ultimate competitor and he doesn't want to be bothered. He wants to go about his business and he wants to win. I just don't think he's going to, I'm afraid if he goes that he's going to get over there and be like, this is too laid back. This is too chill. I'm a legend in this game. That was a bit of a mistake because I used to compete on, and I know that the tour's changed and it's not the same as it was. And hopefully Tiger and these guys being involved, that it will change for the better. But right now he can say, you know what? The PGA Tour is a mess right now, is what John Rahm's thinking. The PGA Tour is a mess. They're not calling me for anything. I got LIV Golf calling me right now and offering me $300 million, $600 million, whatever you say. It doesn't matter. It's a lot of money. It's something that if somebody ever offers you that, you should consider it.
Yes, 100%. So crazy not to.
With that being said, he's offered all this money and he looks at A and B and he says, you know what? I still get to play the majors and I get paid this amount of money. And the only argument I would make is John Rahm is going to be a billionaire, whatever he plays on the PGA Tour or the LIV Golf Tour. And the way I see it, it's like, you know what? For the most competitive golfer that I've ever seen and played with, why would you not stay on the PGA Tour to consider you to build your legacy? And I'll probably add too that, you know, Phil Mickelson and Sergio Garcia are close friends of his. Mm-hmm. And I think him not being at the Hero this week worries me, because the chatter, and he's going to continue to hear from every single one of the players on that tour, where all the guys were here this week. These agents, you know, Tim Mickelson was his agent. Phil Mickelson's a friend. And you just have to be worried that he's going to be convinced to do this. And listen, the money is something you have to consider, but for the reasons I mentioned for his competitive spirit, it doesn't seem like it makes sense for Jon Rahm.
I think that piece is the most important one of everything that we've heard this last week. I mean, you know, the reporting, I know that there are figures that make it a little more real than just the rumors before, but we've seen those tweets before. We've heard that reporting before. We heard and saw a lot of people kind of rebutting this idea, you know, in golf media, people who are close to Jon Rahm. But let's wait till we hear something from his camp. And here's why he said quotes before that he won't go. To me, none of that is important. The only thing that's important in terms of this whole story and all the reporting is the rumor that one of his non-negotiables was going to be a change to LIV's league format. And so my only questions here are not about money and all this other stuff. It's what is the change he's asking for? And is LIV willing to accept and make that change, you know, in order to bring him into the league? Because if he is going to ask for a change that, kind of to your point on the competitiveness, makes this more of a legit, you know, competitor to the PGA Tour, whether that's, you know, something that can make a more legitimate application for world ranking points, whether it's something in terms of the vibe of the competition that makes it more serious. If they make that change, and if LIV's willing to do that, then all of a sudden, I think we have a real problem on our hands. If you're looking at this from the perspective of the PGA Tour, you know, because not only are you losing Jon Rahm, one of the three best players in the world, you're opening up the door to a lot of guys who maybe their hesitance in going lies around, am I going to go kind of play this hit and giggle for the next 5-10 years and make a couple $100 million and then hang it up? You know, or can I go over there and play against some of the best in the world and feel that competitive atmosphere and earn world ranking points to find my way into majors, to keep honing my craft against the best in the world? That to me is a very legitimate worry, I think, at that point. So I haven't seen a ton of additional reporting on that since we first kind of heard that as one of the stipulations. But I think if we do learn more about that and whether or not LIV is amenable to making that change, then it becomes a more legit thing. And I think, kind of, you know, to your point earlier, it's like, I think this has to be a bargaining chip that LIV's using, because remember early on, we heard one of the things that came out of this framework deal was an agreement to not poach players from either side through the end of 2024. And that quickly got removed and struck down. Well, but remember, it was
an antitrust thing, right?
It was antitrust thing. This is the phase of our show where you're having Matt Stoller on and trying to explain to us the antitrust law, which feels like a fever dream from months ago. But, you know, they removed that because of antitrust concerns. And then, of course, you didn't hear anything in the ensuing months, because the assumption was the negotiations must be going well. And so there's no need to ruffle feathers or create any issues, you know, that would maybe torpedo this deal. Well, what's happened in the last couple months that maybe could have changed the tenor there? All the reporting about these interested groups of investors, you know, that, you know, aren't interested in short-term gains, like, you know, private equity we might assume are. They're more interested in the future of the game, and whether or not the deal gets done with the PIF, we're you know, we might have some other options on the table to finance this thing. Well, easy way to counteract that is to kind of stoke the fires of a departure once again, and Jon Rahm is probably the biggest, scariest name you could do there. So I think it's 100% a bargaining chip play by LIV, and by the way, a good one if they can make that move. And you also noted the kind of the deal on him being upset about, you know, the events of June 6th, just kind of as many players were being left in the dark and not being a part of this. And another guy we heard from that a lot this week was Tiger. You know, they asked him, golly, I think 30 plus questions in that initial press conference on Tuesday at the Hero World Challenge, and it was clear in numerous answers how frustrated he was with just, hey, this shouldn't have gone like this, and it'll never happen like this again. I'm curious to kind of play the story forward a little bit. He was asked on Friday about this report that came out about Rahm, and just talking about, you know, hypothetically, it would be a shock, it'd be a surprise, but, you know, a lot of things could happen between now and this December 31st deadline where things could change. And you know, and by the way, Tiger said, look, that's my sole focus. That's the thing that we're trying to get done, you know, to make sure that we have this in the direction we want to have it. So when you heard Tiger, you know, both earlier in the week and just responding to this Rahm report and really focused on that December 31st deadline, you know, does that make you more or less optimistic about this thing staying together?
I think it's going to get extended. I don't think it's going to get done by the end of the year. Okay. I think there's little chance that it does, to be honest. I think it'll get pushed back a little bit. I feel pretty comfortable about saying that with the sources that I have. I mean, maybe it does get done. Who knows? They may start wheeling and dealing and calling and getting this thing figured out. If so, great. But it seems like they have so much to figure out in all this, because when you're restructuring how our tour works, it seems like they're, you know, if we're loading our Wi-Fi here, we're probably at like 20%. I think we're still buffering kind of in the low quarter there. So to me, you know, he offered support too of Jay Monahan, which if John Rahm goes, man, I don't see how that man keeps his job. There's just like somebody has to fall on the sword for this, because when you lose one of your biggest assets and he cites the reason is potentially, you know, the framework agreement of being left in the dark and having no trust in the leadership. I mean, yeah, somebody has to go. And that's what worries me the most in all this, is that I just don't think there's enough alignment from the executives to the leadership to the players. I think there's a disconnect every which way right now. We've seen from the group of players that are playing in the open events reported by No Laying Up, I saw that there's a PGA Tour petition citing that the signature events are going to be making 272% more than the open events. So with that being said, you're like, okay, now you have the middle tier, lower tier PGA Tour players speaking up, and then you have the players at the top that are trying to keep the tour together, and especially keeping their strongest assets together to where they feel like they're paid well, that they're paid what they should be paid, that they have the control of the tour, that the PGA Tour is not, you know, a union is something that was always talked about, to where they feel like they're getting the 50-50 cut that they deserve. And people don't like the PIP, but that's something that was enacted just to where it does pay the guys that, you know, drive the game and gets butts in seats. But just, there's just no alignment right now to me. And I don't see how you can make that up in 30 days. And that's where my head goes in all this. It's like, all right, we hear about all this equity. I'm sure there's great conversations and there's really potential great options. And I'm not saying that it can't get done, but with all the things that are going on, it just seems like there's just not enough time in the day to get it all done.
Yeah. To quote you, you referenced that No Laying Up, that membership petition, because I think this was another thing that we didn't even have in the rundown, but was just a piece of news that when I saw this, like, wow, that's going to boil under the surface. I'm not sure who's leading this or where they're going to bring this up. But I mean, these are all very fair points. You know, FedEx Cup points allocated to signature events versus full field events is the top of the list of this petition. And the example they give is that currently a fifth place finish in a no-cut 78-player field is awarded 272% more points than a fifth-place finish in a traditional event with a cut. And they're requesting a significant reduction in those points before the first designated event. And I think it's, you know, that's a fair ask to make. But, you know, kind of to your larger point, there are a lot of things happening. And I would not be shocked by an extension. But I think that I fear for the timelines on all this. You know what I mean? Like if Rahm is saying, I'm trying to make a decision on 2024, it's got to be one way or another. And, you know, even if it's Tiger Woods going to John saying, we feel really good about this, it's like, well, I mean, the tour has told me that a lot of different ways in the past, and they still were willing to kind of do what they did to kind of make this deal without player input. And I don't feel valued. This place is making me feel really valued. I'm going to go ahead and make that call. So,
Don't you think it's kind of a timing thing right now? Like, if this wasn't right now, I think he's probably always had these offers.
Yeah.
You know, this probably isn't his first offer from the Live Golf Tour. You know, if this was, if this all was happening in January or February, he like, dude, stop it. I'm already playing golf right now. I'm not making a change. I'm getting ready for the Masters. I'm already started that prep, but being at home, having, you know, not playing in anything right now and all the time in the world to think about, you know, is this where I should be? You know, like, is this what's best for me and my family? And, or is this best what's, you know, what's best for my career? That's where I feel, you know, I'm concerned that he does make the jump. It's kind of like, do you ever follow college football recruiting or just recruiting in general?
Yeah, like the rest of us sickos. Yeah, I do.
So it's when things like this start to kind of go silent. I know there's confidence from the PGA Tour side that, that John Rahm's going to stay, but I've seen this enough in recruiting. It's that, you know, he's got time to think about all this. And it's like, watch what they do and not what they say. Well, guess what he's not doing? He's not seeing anything, but watch what they do. And we're kind of seeing what that is from other different sources. When I see all that pop up, I'm like,
TGL, Hero.
Yeah,
you
know, it's just
like, give me some space and time and I'm trying to figure something out. I agree.
That's where I'm like, you know, I'm connecting the dots here. Yep. And I'm not saying he's going. I get worried that there's not enough time to convince him that, because it's all changing right now. Like, it's nothing is set in stone on what's going to happen on the PGA Tour. There was a memo sent out to the players recently, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a final thing. It wasn't something that's dead set official on what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think I very much agree with you. I think that if you're trying to kind of look at it from both sides, like, I think timing hurts for sure for all the reasons you listed, but helps in that if the competitive structure of LIV is really important to John Rahm, which it seems that it is, that's also a timing thing on their side. I mean, it was just, you know, maybe even the last week or so where we saw Brooks Koepka surfacing in every comment section of Instagram posts on LIV saying, where's the schedule? Where's the schedule? Where's the schedule? Like, it's not like they're the most on top of it league. So if they're having trouble putting together, you know,
which where I love we're gonna, that bit, right?
It's such a good bit and such a Brooks Koepka-esque bit. It's just hilarious. But if they're having trouble with the basic details of like, what our tournament's going to be and where are we going to play them? And then all of a sudden you have a guy who, and I get it, you'll probably move heaven and earth for John Rahm, but if he's showing up asking for huge changes to the nature of these events to satisfy what he wants from a competitive standpoint, that also works against them from a time perspective. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's, you know, like everything that's happened in golf in the last couple of years, like, it's kind of a toss up. I think probably if he gets the thing he wants, he goes, but I also think that it's a big ask of LIV and they're going to have to move some stuff around to make it happen. And especially, I think the tough thing there is that they're all doing that for the sake of then submitting to a very official organization that has very delayed and set timelines in the OWGR in terms of how things get processed. It's not like they're going to be like, we just made all these changes. Hey, can we get these points for this next season? Like, that's obviously not going to happen, but you know, they're going to have to do it in 2024 to then have a case to present to the OWGR and saying, look, we made these changes. Now, can we look at 25, 26? And so,
dude, I hope we'll get points. Like, I hope shape or form that they get points. The official world golf ranking is basically the FedEx Cup. It seriously is. You know, there's too many really good players on the LIV Golf Tour that should be ranked properly. I don't know how you do it. And everybody can listen to this and say, well, they knew what they were doing when they left. I mean, dude, the job of the World Golf Ranking Committee is to rank the players. And I know that players that got picked that didn't earn their way on it, and there's no way for anybody to get there. I get there's different qualifications, but we have got to find a way to rank these players correctly.
Well, and like, look at like the points they gave out this week for the Hero World Challenge. And I'm not like arguing against giving out those points, you know, sums for 20 of the best players in the world. But it just is a really hard sell then to be like, no, we're not going to give those.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
To live players. I just, you know, it's just tough. And
the 54 hole thing doesn't bother me. I don't think that's an issue. The shotgun thing doesn't even bother me. They're all playing the same holes. None of it really bothers me. It's the players that, and first off, they've already played their way off of that tour. You know, I just don't see like the huge argument against, like, it doesn't affect the PGA Tour players right now, unless it's getting into some major championships. But we're talking about, you know, a pretty small group of people that are fighting for these official world golf ranking points and major championship slots, because that's really all they're going to be playing together on are those events.
Well, I think a lot of those tour pros too would tell you that they kind of want those guys there. For yes. the legitimacy of the event. I mean, it's like, yes. it's not like they just want to win an asterisk trophy.
I want to see Taylor Gooch. Like, I want to see him go up against these guys four times a year at a major. And he played well enough, clearly, to be in the top 50 in the world, but he's probably outside the top 150 now. So yeah. It's a sensitive topic because there's so many people that are so against LIV. And I'm just so pro these guys, the best players in the world, playing against each other. And that's all I care about. All I care about are these guys playing and competing against each other, the best players. And right now we're trending on a 10-year deal to where we're just going to see PGA Tour players playing in major championships outside of five or six dudes.
Yeah.
And that's not right.
Well, and it's something that maybe we can unpack in further detail, whether it's with the guests or someone else, you know, the future of what this all looks like. But I think it's worth, whatever side you're on this, whether you're big, you know, pro PGA Tour or you're pro LIV, is like, can we start to take a look at an ecosystem that makes both sides as happy as they can be, and how we could preserve, you know, the sanctity of the most important events in the game, you know, so that they are involving the best players in golf, and maybe preserve the sanctity of some PGA Tour events while also accommodating for a combined ecosystem where we get to see the best players in the game on some regular, you know, basis, instead of, you know, shutting them out on a points basis. Like, I'm not saying I love LIV Tour. It's not something I watch particularly, but you know, kind of to your point, there are a lot of guys there that I would love to see playing against guys currently on the PGA Tour. And it's just
Joaquin won this week.
He did, and he's in the Open Championship as a result of it. You know, and that's a guy that missed out on a lot of majors last year. So, not to cut this short, but we are late in the show, and we haven't hit maybe even the most charged topic of the week, which is the rollback of the golf ball.
I'll be quick.
Yeah. Well, I think
we can get into it later too. This is not going to stop.
Well, the headline here is basically that the USGA and the RNA, of course, you know, at the beginning of the year, announced the fact that they had to make some sort of change. And the first proposal was bifurcation. And I'm sure many of you know what that means, but just a simple explainer for those of you who don't, that the pros would be playing one golf ball that would be rolled back, and that normal amateur players would continue playing the same golf ball with no limitations on distance, spin, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the arguments there was that bifurcation could hurt the game at a number of levels. Where do you draw the line? How does that impact the relationship between being able to play the same equipment, pros, amateurs? There are a lot of arguments and all feedback that the USGA and the RNA took under advisement. And then the report that came out this last week was that the announcement would be that there would be a rollback, but it'll be for everybody so as to avoid bifurcation. So now the people who are upset are not the pros and the ball manufacturers. It's all the random Joes at home and, you know, people like me who are like, wait a second, I'm going to hit the ball a lot shorter now. And it was already hard enough as it stood. So the jumping off point I want to take for us here is reading a tweet that Rory put out and kind of reacting to that. So this is something Rory said earlier today. Well, I guess this is tomorrow, but
he's been doing a ton of social media stuff. So like, this is probably his first statement in a while.
Well, he's been strong on this. He's kept the same line the entire time. And so he says, I don't understand the anger about the golf ball rollback. It will make no difference whatsoever to the average golfer and puts golf back on a path of sustainability. It will also help bring back certain skills in the pro game that have been eradicated over the past two decades. The people who are upset about this decision shouldn't be mad at the governing bodies. They should be mad at elite pros and club and ball manufacturers because they didn't want bifurcation. The governing bodies presented us with that option earlier this year. Elite pros and ball manufacturers think bifurcation would negatively affect their bottom lines when in reality, the game is already bifurcated. You think we play the same stuff you do? They put pressure on the governing bodies to roll it back to a lesser degree for everyone. Bifurcation was the logical answer for everyone, but yet again in this game, money talks. This is where, Smiley, I put on my tinfoil hat. I get my in my conspiracy theory lane, and I say, I think this was a galaxy brain play by the USGA and the RNA, knowing that they had to do something and trying to figure out how they could get out of this with the least amount of flack taken. And so by rolling out bifurcation first, they were able to allow for all this feedback and all these pros and ball manufacturers getting upset. And then when it comes back around, it says, look, our hands were tied. We had no other choice. We offer that option, but they hated it. So now we have to do it for everyone. So if you want to be upset with them. I don't know. That's a bit of a conspiracy theory, but I just think at this stage in the game, it's just like, I feel like there are two or three twists left, but I'm just curious where you kind of stand on the whole rollback issue, where we are right now.
I go back and forth. You know, I really do, because I see what the long players do to golf courses. And personally, I think the golf ball doesn't curve enough. I think the golf ball goes too far. So I do agree in that sense that I would like to see the golf ball rolled back. But for me, I don't want to play a rolled back ball. So it's for the guys that I cover, because I don't want to play a ball that's rolled back. I want to keep hitting it far. So I can understand these players that feel the same way that I do, but I watch it and I'm like, you know what? It would be cool for the golf ball to not go that far. So it's weird, right? Because the PGA Tour already said they'd be against it. And so now we're talking about only a few events a year that these players are going to have to play a different golf ball for, which are the potential events that define players' careers. That to me is if this was my window of when I'm playing professional golf, that would bother the shit out of me, especially when we talk about at the end of the year. It's like, man, they only get so few opportunities to create a legacy, to win a major championship. And everything has got to be right. You need a little bit of luck, and it's hard to do. And now you're throwing in the skill level component where it's like, how do you, you know, when do you start playing this golf ball? Is it 2 weeks before? So you start knowing how that golf ball is going to react at the US Open. There's a lot of twists and turns.
If I could stop you there, because I think that's the whole point, at least as the USGA and the RNA lay it out, is that's the whole point of the full rollback, is that there is no two different golf balls. You know, instead of it being because I guess to play out what you're saying is that now you're asking the manufacturers to keep making the existing golf ball and make the one that conforms. But I think the whole point of the full rollback is that there will only be one golf ball for everybody going into the future. So as far as I can understand it or see it, it's that you shifted the people who are mad at you from being pros and ball manufacturers, and now it's the millions of golfers, you know, who play the game on an everyday basis who didn't really even want to be a part of this and didn't need rollback. But now, you know, what they're doing is they're easing the burden on a Titleist, let's say, or any ball manufacturer. And
is
saying,
bifurcation and rollback the same thing? Because just made it.
Well, rollback is the larger topic. It's just talking about what happens when a rollback happens. Are we saying that there are a set of standards for a golf ball that only apply to professional golfers, or there are a set of standards rolling it back that apply to everybody? And so basically, if there's bifurcation, the ask you're making of a ball manufacturer is to produce one ball that can be played by a tour pro in any event where the rules are set by the USGA and the RNA, and continue to produce the same ball that every amateur player is used to that plays, you know, on a weekend and is not subject to those same restrictions. But so this most recent piece of news is just wiping bifurcation off the table and saying, you know what, instead of this split where Titleist or whatever ball manufacturer has to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on more research and development to produce this tour ball that's separate from the regular ball, everyone's going back And we're all subject to the same restrictions.
I hate that.
I think it brings up some weird things because now I was talking to some buddies about this at the bar on Saturday night, and it was like, man, like if they roll the ball back for everyone, and like I stockpiled a bunch of old balls, or like I go in the woods and I find a ball, you know, and we're playing like a money game, even if it's like a, you know, 10-10-20 NASA.
It's
like
it's a big deal.
I'm kind of on the tee. I'm like, what are you playing there? Can I take a look at your ball? You know, it's like, I mean, that's the reality of the competition. You know, you're playing like in a club championship. It's your cheating. I know. And that's why I think it's kind of like a bum deal for the regular Joe golfer.
What a mess, dude. Golf is a mess.
It's crazy. But I just think it's like it pushes it back on the people that are. It's like there's not a ton of ways to voice their say. You know, it's like the pros and the manufacturers can have a outspoken voice in this whole thing because they drive the top tier of the game. But, you know, the people at the lower levels, it's not like there's a, you know, other than continuing to, I don't know, post things about it on the internet or not renew their memberships with the USGA. I don't quite know how they affect change. But I think that's what I say. I think this was just like a big brain play to get here. They always knew they were going here, but they wanted to kind of scapegoat pros and manufacturers first by suggesting bifurcation, knowing that they were going to push back on it. So I don't know.
I'm done with it. I'm done with it. Dude, I've talked too much.
Is that too much information?
Yeah, I'm too much. Too much.
Well, I can promise you this. We'll have smarter people on the show soon, and those smart people will help us unpack it in better, more nuanced ways. But that's all for us this week, or not this week. I guess it's all for us for today. We'll have more for you this week, and we'll see you back in Birmingham, Alabama, once you fly back from sunny Bahamas. Any closing thoughts for the people?
No closing thoughts, man. That was the last event I'm going to work this year. So year one is in the books, calling golf. A lot of fun, man. Look forward to 2024 starting Kapalua, but have some time off with the fam, do some Christmas and all that, but still providing some content through this podcast as well in the coming weeks. So a lot of good stuff to come.
Absolutely true. Looking forward to seeing my North Carolina Tar Heels in the Duke's Mayo Bowl against West Virginia.
Y'all should just get like a locker room for that. You're just playing that every year, right?
That statement was dripping in sarcasm for anyone who didn't understand that. I just dismantled the program. Also dismantled the ACC while we're at it. But that's all we got for this week.
Wait, yeah, are we going to go into the college football discussion now? Okay, yeah, let's just shut the show off.
I mean, seriously, you go undefeated in the ACC. And that doesn't get you a trip into the college football playoff.
It just means more.
I can't even. I'll say this to close the show. Boo Corrigan, the chair of the college football playoff and the athletic director at NC State. Congratulations. You torpedoed your own conference. Hope you're happy with yourself. And when we never get to play each other again, because the ACC is now going to cease to exist. So thanks. And thanks to all of you for listening and watching. We will see you back here soon on The Smiley Show.
The Smiley Show is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcast.